Hello. It's on. Good evening, everyone. I'd like to welcome you this evening to the fifth and final lecture in our series, Scales of the Universe. My name is Amy Harris. I'm the director of the University of Michigan Exhibit Museum of Natural History across the street, and we're one of the co-sponsors of this series, along with the Department of Astronomy and the Student Astronomical Society and the Michigan Center for Theoretical Physics. I'd like to ask all of you who have cell phones to silence them at this point. And I'd like to let you know that after tonight's lecture, we will have some opportunities for you to continue learning about astronomy. We have 30 places for people to go to the Exhibit Museum's new digital planetarium. I'm going to have 15 tickets, they're free tickets, down here in front. And Matt Linke, who's right up the aisle from me, will have the other 15, and we'll hand them out. And when they're gone, those will be the folks who can go to the planetarium. And then out this back door, you can accompany the Student Astronomical Society to Angel Hall. They're going to have a telescope set up, and depending on the cloud cover, you may be able to see the moon or more. And so I hope you'll take advantage of those opportunities. I also wanted to mention that on Saturday, December 8th, there's a card like this in the back. The Exhibit Museum has a Family Space Discovery Day, and some of our audience members are participating in that, including the Student Astronomical Society and the University Lowbrow Society. So now I'd like to turn things over to Professor Doug Richstone, who's the chair of the Department of Astronomy, and he's going to do our introduction.
It's a distinct pleasure for me to introduce Michael Turner tonight. I don't want to talk very long because his talk is going to be much better than mine. But because it's such a pleasure for me, I do want to say a little bit about him. I've known him or recognized him since we were both undergrads at Caltech a long time ago. And he's always been, in some ways, the way that you will see him tonight, which is extremely entertaining as well as insightful. He is currently the Bruce and Diane Rauner Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago and chair of their Department of Astronomy and Astrophysics. There are a number of his accomplishments and recognitions in the inside leaf of your folder, and I won't repeat all of them, but I do want to note that he's one of the inventors of the field of particle astrophysics. That's the study of the physics of the early universe. He wrote the book, literally, with Rocky Cobb, on the early universe. And he invented the term dark energy, which is the newest and, I think, most important idea in cosmology today. Now, I do want to mention one other thing. This is the Orrin Moeller Prize lecture. Former Moeller lecturers have included Bodan Pachinski, Sandy Faber, David Spergel, Alan Sandage, Joe Taylor, and Edwin Saltpeter. Start to forget names. And Michael will have recognized that three of those individuals have won either Crawford Prizes or a Nobel Prize, and they did that after they gave the Moeller lecture. So I certainly, and many of the others subsequently won Russell Prizes from the American Astronomical Society. So this is not predictive, but we call on you to do more and be further recognized after this occasion. And there is a prize, which I will present to you now, and then it's your turn.
Thank you very much. Well, there's really just one thing that I want to say tonight, and then we can all go home. Crypto Blue. And I'm sure there are a handful of you who wandered in because it was too cold out there at the pep rally. And I do appreciate you coming in. And as a bonus for all of you who stay until the end, I will be revealing the score of tomorrow's game. And I do think it will be worth waiting for. Let's see if this works. And does somebody know? I don't have to adjust these lights, do I? Yeah, okay. We live near a big city, and people get nervous when the lights go down. At least they do in Chicago. So this has been a wonderful lecture series. And I can say that with great expertise because this is the first one I'll have been at. But the theme was fantastic, the scales of the universe. And, of course, we know that in astronomy, that's the time scales and the distance scales are astronomical. And what that means is they span great ranges. And this lecture series, for those of you who have come to all the lectures, span great ranges, starting out in the solar system and working out to the solar neighborhood and the galaxy and clusters of galaxies. And so I have the privilege of batting cleanup here and talking about not a particular scale, but talking about something that I think is very exciting, connections between the smallest scales, the scales of the elementary particles, and the largest scales in the universe. And this is something that is quite unexpected. I think it's quite profound, and I hope by the end of this you will appreciate this deep connection. It's also fun. You know, we're having a lot of fun here, so I'll mention that at the end. And so, first of all, I want to show you a full-scale model. I think it's to the right size. I was here. We've been adjusting the size of the screen and all of that all evening to get this just right. This is a full-scale model of the universe, a fraction of a second after the beginning. All that we can see today was that. And so that's, you know, it's not just, and now you know this is not a comedy line because the writers have been on strike, and so this is science. So all that we can see, just a fraction of a second after the bang, fit in a soup can like this, and it was just a hot soup of the elementary particles. So everybody knows about quarks and leptons, right? You know, the smallest particles that everything's made of, three quarks to a neutron and a proton, and then the leptons are the electron and its friends. And so in the beginning, the universe was incredibly simple, and it began as quark soup. Okay. And we can trace the history of the universe from this quark soup can until today. This is called the Hot Big Bang model. It's one of the great intellectual achievements of the 20th century. And it starts, I'm going to do it in real time. It just takes about 13.7 billion years. Oh, you guys have a game tomorrow. Yeah, so I'll be done before the game. At a fraction of a second after the beginning, at about 1/100,000 seconds and earlier, the universe was unbelievably simple, just this soup of quarks and leptons. And the history of the universe that we can now trace from that very early time is cooling, expanding, and building layer upon layer of structure. So first the quarks form into neutrons and protons. And I know all of you took, you know, this is such a, you know, it's not like Ohio State where, I mean, in this state, that wouldn't even like be a junior college, right? Do I have the spirit? I have this. Okay. Sorry. So blue. And so, of course, you know that neutrons are green and protons are blue. And then when the universe is seconds old, it's a nuclear reactor, and the nuclei of the light elements are formed, in particular helium and lithium and deuterium, which is a heavy form of hydrogen. And then when the universe is around 400,000 years old, the nuclei catch up, capture electrons, and form the atoms. So again, it's layer upon layer of structure. We'll come back to this 400,000 years. This is a very interesting time. We have a snapshot of the universe at that time. And then gravity takes over, and gravity is the master builder. So just remember that. It wasn't Courvoisier. It was gravity as the master builder. And it builds up the structure that we see from galaxies to clusters of galaxies and so on and so forth, and here we are. And we can trace this out, this history. That's not what this lecture is about, but we can trace the history of the universe from that very early time to today. And I'll talk about the evidence in a minute, but we measure these leftover elements, and we can see the universe. We can see light from this time of 400,000 years and so on and so forth. So you might think that this connection between quarks and the cosmos is that the cosmos fit in this quark soup can at the beginning. And that's pretty amazing. That is absolutely very amazing. But the connections go far beyond that fact. They're much more profound. And so I told you the easy one, just to get you going. It began with quark soup. But I want to talk about the deeper connections that there are. And just to convince you that this connection, because we're in a chemistry building here, so the atoms are made out of quarks. And no one has ever talked about the deep connections between quarks and chemistry. Okay, so the connections go far beyond the fact that that everybody started out as quark stuff. Right? That line didn't work. It worked for Carl Sagan, star stuff. But we all started out as quark stuff. Okay, so what are those deep connections? Without these deep connections between the quarks and the cosmos, we wouldn't have the atoms that we're made out of. So our atoms owe their existence to this deep. And it's not just, again, that atoms are made of the quarks. So I'll tell you about that. I blanked it. There we go. So I'm going to tell you that most of the universe is not atoms anyway. The universe is held together by this mysterious dark matter. And again, the dark matter owes its existence to these connections between the very big and the very small. And then the stuff that gets me up in the morning, my Wheaties, is dark energy. And I'm just a little bit worried because, you know, my trainer calling it the clear and the something else. So I'm hoping this doesn't turn out to be a steroid or something like that. But so the dark energy that's causing the expansion of the universe to speed up. Again, this is one of these deep connections. And then the best connection of all, the one that I'm going to talk about first, is that all these structures we see in the universe, the galaxies and the clusters and the stars, all started out, and I'm going to say this and explain it later, as subatomic quantum fluctuations. So the biggest things we can imagine started out as the smallest things that we can try to imagine. So these connections are very deep. These are connections that we just realized they were unexpected, and the community is still reeling from it. You know, Doug Richstone, who's the chairman of the astronomy department, 10 years ago did not like all these particle physicists coming over to his side. So these are really important connections between the very big and the very small, and that's what I want to talk about. Just a little bit of background. I want to remind you about the evidence, how we know about the quark soup and the expanding universe. So, of course, it was Hubble, University of Chicago graduate, Big Ten basketball player. That was when we used to win the Monsters of the Midway. He discovered that the universe is expanding, that the other galaxies are moving away from us, indicated by the arrows here. And that was an important discovery in 1929. It told us that our universe had a beginning. Because if things are getting bigger, in the past they were smaller, and if you extrapolate this back, it's this beginning about 13.7 years ago. And this guy, Einstein, plays a very important role. We will visit him a lot in this talk. The trouble is that all these darn experimentalists, they get all the credit, for this. But without the hand wavers, without the theorists, we wouldn't understand this. And what Einstein said is, this isn't like a firecracker exploding. That's not what it is. It's the expansion of space The galaxies are being carried along. Space is getting bigger. The galaxies are being carried along. That's why it looks like other galaxies are moving away. And I just want to illustrate that. So there's some pretty galaxies. And now we'll just, by the magic of PowerPoint, make that picture larger. So same galaxies further apart, same galaxies further apart, three different designer colors. And now let's look at what it looks like, because everybody wants to know if we're at the center of the universe. And so we're gonna see what this picture looks like from that galaxy. So watch that galaxy. As time goes on, it sees the other ones move away, and so it thinks that it's at the center. But now we'll pick another galaxy, and this is the hardest part of the talk. I think it's this galaxy that we pick. So now let's see what that galaxy thinks is going on. So it sees other galaxies moving away, like so. Ooh, magic. Everybody's at the center because of this expansion of space. And then just because some of you, you know, it takes three times to... Oh, no, there's no Ohio State folks here. Well, there might be one or two. So we focus on this galaxy, and you pick any galaxy, and because of this magic of expansion of space, there is no center. Everybody thinks they're at the center. Okay. Let me just briefly pause upon or talk about the evidence for this. So in science, you got to have evidence. I worked in Washington for 3 years, and it was really fun because, you know, we weren't part of the reality-based community. Our motto was make our own reality. And here I am back to being a scientist. And in science, you have to have evidence. So when we say the universe began from a Big Bang, we've got evidence. And so I talked about the expansion of the universe. I talked about the abundance of these elements that were made in the Big Bang. Actually, I didn't tell you where the rest of the elements were made, the ones over here. They're made in stars about a billion years later. But these light elements are very special. The helium is very special. It was made in the Big Bang. One of the things that we now brag about is that when we try to compare ages for the universe, the time back to the Big Bang, the age of the oldest stars, the age of some of the elements that are made are radioactive and act like clocks, white dwarf stars cool and act like clocks, and then the age of the oldest astronomers, and we compare those, and they're all about the same. And then I'll talk very briefly about this, that we understand how the galaxies and clusters were made. They were made by gravity, and I'll come back to that in a second. Here's Hubble's original data, and you can't see it very well, but it's really bad. He had a good eye. This is a version of it that was measured by Wendy Friedman, who led the Hubble Key Project and straightened out this data. And the data is much, much better, and the universe really is expanding, and we've measured its rate to about a few percent. And then let me talk about the microwave echo of the Big Bang. That's really important. These two gentlemen, Arno Penzias and Bob Wilson, in 1964, discovered that the universe was filled with microwaves. And that was before the invention of the microwave oven. And there was a nice little detective story, and these microwaves are the heat of the Big Bang left over. So leftover heat of the Big Bang. And they give us a picture of the universe when it was only 400,000 years old. And let me explain that. Here's a picture. Here's where we are. We look out in space. We look back in time. Everybody knows a telescope is a time machine, right? Okay. So you look out in space. You look back in time. And I'll show you an image from Hubble. Where we're looking back to when galaxies are being born. We're looking back to a few billion years after the Big Bang. And then we can't see anymore because there's nothing to see because stars haven't formed yet. And the farthest back that we can see are these microwaves that come from the Big Bang. And if you trace them back, they last interacted with matter when the universe was about 400,000 years old. And so we're looking at the universe when we look at those microwaves when it was about 400,000 years old. In much the same way, I'm going to ask you to twist this line another way and to get your head around this. Imagine, think about looking at the sun. Think about looking at the sun. Where did the light from the sun come from? The center of the sun, right? When you look at the sun, now please don't do that. Well, there's no Ohio State folks here, so we don't. But When you look at the sun, you do not see the center of the sun. You don't see where the light or the photons were made. You see where they last scatter, right? So they bounce their way out. On the surface, they last scattered, and you see the surface of the sun. Okay? And it's the same with the Big Bang. So there were photons. We're going back in time. There was a lot of heat in the Big Bang. There were a lot of photons. And when the universe was ionized, before it was atoms, when it was just nuclei and electrons, the photons are constantly bumping into electrons, just like in the sun. And then when the universe became atoms, it was transparent to the radiation, and the photons came here. And that's good. And it allows us to see the universe when it's 400,000 years old. Let me show you the picture you paid for. It was only $140 million. It was a bargain. This is the microwave sky taken by a satellite called the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe. You know, this just, if you're a cosmologist, this causes your heart to flutter. I don't hear any fluttering hearts in here. This is the entire sky, you know, laid down on a piece of paper, just like when we take the Earth and lay it down on a piece of paper. So this is all directions. This is one of these silly false color things where the red means the intensity is higher and blue means the intensity is lower, intensity of microwaves. And the variation in intensity is really, really hard to measure it. In fact, they could not measure it in Florida. Let me explain why. The variations in the intensity of these microwaves is less than 0.001%. Now, in the year 2000, there was a difference in something or other that was 0.001% that was not measured so accurately. And here, cosmologists measured this extremely accurately. And so this is what the universe looked like at 400,000 years. And so how many of you can see galaxies? Raise your hand. No one can see one person. Okay, we're going to do some drug testing afterwards. There were no galaxies, there were no stars. This is mapping out the distribution of matter in the universe, and the universe was slightly lumpy. Lumpy at the level of 0.001%. It was smoother than anything in your refrigerator. Okay? Well, that's easy in my refrigerator, but... And so it was slightly lumpy. We'll talk more about this picture later. This is a really great picture. There were no galaxies, no stars, just a tiny amount of lumpiness. And that lumpiness, the fact that in some places where it's red, there was more matter, gravity, there was more gravity, and gravity's the master builder. And after 13.7 billion years of there being more matter, it pulls in more matter. You know, the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. Here, there's not so much matter. It builds up galaxies and all the structure that we see today. So this is a fantastic, this lumpiness is the seeds of structure. Okay. So now that's the review of what we know. And now let me talk about these deep connections. So an obvious question after you heard that, and I heard this gentleman whispering it to me in my ear here, is where did the lumpy quark soup come from? So where did that come from? Where did the quark soup come from, and where did the tiny little lumps? Because I was really paying attention, and the lumps, the variations, that lumpiness is really important. If it were absolutely smooth, there would never be any galaxies. Okay, good. So let me tell you where we think it came from. And this is a fabulous story, not quite proven yet, but we've got some pretty good evidence that we're on the right track. And it goes under the name of cosmic inflation. The main thing you need to look at here is this line here. What is inflation? It's a short period in the history of the universe when it expanded extraordinarily rapidly. In a tiny amount of time, in this amount of time, we call that a jiffy. In one jiffy, it expanded by a greater factor than it has since. So just a tremendous amount of expansion. For those of you who have to know about this, this is related to, again, elementary particle physics and the physics of the very small. This involves expansion driven by the false vacuum energy of a scalar field. You don't have to understand what that is, but there were some physics in the early universe that caused the universe to expand extraordinarily rapidly. And this is very important because it means that a tiny little bit of the universe can become extraordinarily large and encompass everything we see and can simultaneously explain a bunch of things. Number one, the most extraordinary thing about this previous picture is, why is it that our universe is so smooth? Well, the reason it's so smooth, according to inflation, is that it came from the tiniest little bit of the universe. And the mathematicians tell you that if you focus down on the tiniest little bit of anything, it looks very smooth. And so the reason it's smooth is it was just a tiny little bit of space that was blown up. And also, if it had any curvature, that curvature, when you make a balloon really big, a small balloon looks curved. If you blow up the balloon really big, it doesn't seem curved anymore. Okay. Now, the most amazing thing is, how did we make the lumpiness? So this is how physicists draw lumpiness. This is space, and this is more matter here and less matter there. Okay? But the problem is, in the universe today, this lumpiness occurs, a galaxy's big, almost a million light years across. How do you do that? Well, in the subatomic quantum world, things can't be steady or constant. Things bounce around. They fluctuate. That's what quantum mechanics is all about, the uncertainty principle. And so this is my picture of the subatomic quantum world, and you don't need to know what's fluctuating around. But just, you know, in that world, things are changing and fluctuating. And so here we have something in the subatomic world. There's an incredible mismatch of scales here. This is like the size of an atom, and this is, you know, a million light years. So how do you connect this to that? Oh, it's the tremendous expansion. So everything gets expanded in the expanding universe. So these fluctuations get expanded in length size, and they go from subatomic to really big. And that's how a fluctuation on a scale smaller than an atom, quantum fluctuation on a scale smaller than an atom, can become lumpiness, variations in the density on really big scales. Okay. That's a really big idea. I know you're trying to wrap your heads around that. So let me just say something about inflation. So what is so good about it? It's this early period of tremendous expansion driven by something we call vacuum energy, but that has to do with the world of particles. Doesn't matter exactly what it is. When that vacuum energy disappears, when it decays, it produces heat. Oh, it produces the hot quark soup. Okay. It produces a universe that should be uncurved. It produces the lumpiness. It produces the big features of the universe. And so that's called inflation. And the way we test this idea is by carefully staring at that picture. Now, what the heck does that picture look like? Well, actually, it looks, you know, I'd ask one of the youngest members of the audience, because they would say it looks like nothing. It looks like noise, which is, in fact, what it is. But if you analyze it carefully, if you use fancy mathematics to analyze it, compare the intensity of one point with another point so many degrees away, out pops this amazing curve. So this is comparing the intensity of the radiation at one point and another point separated by an angle 2 degrees, 1 degree, a half a degree, and look what pops out. These are called, we have a technical name for them, they're called acoustic peaks. But this is exactly what the theory predicts. So that's what inflation predicts, that you see when you do this mathematical operation that the kind of fluctuations that are produced are such that when you compare them on different angles, you get this. And so you can see the data are not perfect. We have some more work to do. But this is an important test of inflation. And I think a couple years ago, you heard about this satellite WMAP. These fantastic results. We learned a lot from it. We learned how old the universe is by analyzing these bumps and wiggles. The position of this first bump tells us that our universe is uncurved, and it tells us how much atomic matter there is, 4% of the critical density. It tells us how old the universe is. Let me just talk about the flatness, because that was an important test of inflation. What Einstein told us is that there are different kinds of universes. There are universes that are uncurved, the easy ones. There are universes that curve back on themselves. And this is the two-dimensional analog, like the surface of a balloon. And then there are universes that are shaped like a saddle. And people have a hard time understanding these two. And guess what? The good news is that WMAT told us this is our universe, the simple one. So it's uncurved. And I didn't mean to say that our universe is two-dimensional, but we can't see a curved three-dimensional surface. So I'm just and that's what inflation said. And so there's a whole series of predictions that inflation makes, and I'm the official scorekeeper, which doesn't quite seem fair, but I think somebody from Michigan State will keep score tomorrow, and so we'll. So the flat universe, that's a prediction of inflation, and we've done really well. That the lumpiness came from quantum fluctuations. One of the predictions is you see those nice, what we call acoustic peaks. Let's just have fun. Oops, let's have fun with those. So you definitely see their acoustic peaks, right? There's at least one, right? Everybody see a second one? Third one? Fourth one? Fifth one? Sixth one? Well, if you're a theorist, you can see six. Okay. And so this is an important test of this idea. And let me go to this slide, because I think you're going to see this slide in every textbook. And this is going to be the poster child of this deep connection between inner space and outer space. So remember, the idea here is that the biggest things we know of today were seeded by the smallest things that we can imagine, the quantum fluctuations. And so when you go out and put on your microwave glasses, where's Jan? We brought the microwave glasses, right? So people can see the microwave background afterwards. Right. Okay, maybe you forgot them. But when you look at the microwave background and you see these variations in the intensity, here's what you're really seeing. You're seeing the biggest IMAX ever. So you are seeing projected on the full sky quantum fluctuations, and when you look about this much of the sky, about 10 degrees of the sky, what you are really seeing is the quantum world on a length scale of less than a billionth the size of a proton. That's being projected on the sky. That's what you're really seeing. Okay? That's pretty cool, isn't it? Is that a connection between the really little and the really large? I think so. Okay. Let's shift gears now. That was fun. So we're gonna talk about a pretty picture here. And the Hubble Deep Field, this one cost you $2 billion, but it was really worth it. It was really worth it. You did not get... And Hubble pointed for 2 weeks in one direction of the sky. And so this answers the question, how far can you see on a clear day? And let me just orient you. This is 1/40 millionth of the sky. 1/40 millionth. And for those of you who don't believe me, in that tiny, tiny bit of the sky, it really is that tiny, there is one star. So you go out at night, well, I guess you guys see stars here. It's such a small part of the sky that even with a powerful telescope, in that one part of the sky, you only see one star. The rest are galaxies. And you can count them. There are 1,512. Actually, I don't know how many there are. There are about 1,500. Each one of these is a galaxy. Multiply that by 40 million, because that's only a 40 millionth of the sky, and you get 100 billion galaxies in the universe. Okay, but wait, we're not done. Why don't we see more? Right? Why don't we see more? Well, this is as far as you can see because you're looking so far out in space that you're looking back to the time when galaxies were formed. And you can't see further because if you were seeing further, you'd be looking back to the time before there were galaxies. And what I really, you know, I wanted to prove to you that you got your money's worth on the Hubble, but you all know that. But what I really want you to see here are the dark spots, because although, you know, the bright lights are interesting to look at, most of the universe is dark stuff. So we're now going to go to the dark side. So, you know, let's not get seduced by the bright lights. They're pretty to look at, but the dark side is really where it's at. So just to give you a sense of the universe, stars, the bright stuff, account for 0.5%. In round numbers, there's stuff called dark matter. I'm going to tell you about both dark matter and dark energy, and they're both connected to quarks. The dark matter is about 1/3, and there will be a quiz at the end. And 2/3 is the dark energy. And you've got to know the difference between dark matter and dark energy. And the dark matter, it's just particles that have funny names. They don't give off light. They have regular old gravity, and they hold together our galaxy. You got it? The dark energy is really, really weird. It's not particles. It's pushing the universe apart. It gives us headaches. We don't have the slightest clue what it is. But I'll tell you what I think it is. Okay. So let me tell you a little bit about dark matter. So this is the guy who first discovered dark matter, Fritz Zwicky. Flip him around here. So, you know, in the present era, he would get sent home with a little note pinned on him, says doesn't play well with others. And here he's describing what he believed was a technical term that referred to his colleagues, the spherical bastard. And the spherical bastard is the bastard, the person that no matter what direction you approach them, there's no good way to approach them. But he was a really smart guy, and he discovered dark matter. But because he was wearing this little sign, people didn't really pay that much attention to him. And he was studying in the 1930s. They're still very beautiful to look at. And here in Michigan, you have some of the world's experts on clusters of galaxies. So cluster galaxies is a bunch of galaxies in one place held together by gravity. And this is the Coma Cluster, one of the ones he discovered and studied. And each one of these fuzzy things is a galaxy. And there's a whole bunch of them, 3,000 in one place. And there's Zwicky's fingerprint. This is extra rare. And what he did was measure the motions of those galaxies. So they in the picture, they don't look like they're moving. But when you measure them, they are moving, and they're moving fast, thousands of kilometers per second. And so Zwicky asked himself the following question: how is it that this cluster, why doesn't it just fly apart? And you all know the answer. It's the same reason that the solar system doesn't fly apart. Gravity. And the story here is just a little bit different. So let's follow this galaxy. So it wants to move out like that. But as it moves out like that, the gravity of all the stars and all the other galaxies tug back on it, and it falls back in, and then it goes out the other side. And each one of these galaxies does a little dance. And we're seeing a snapshot of it. But what holds the thing together and keep it from flying apart is the gravity of all the stars. But Zwicky discovered that there was a tiny little problem with that story. And the tiny little problem with that story was that the gravity of all the stars was not enough to hold these clusters together. And this was a big problem, off by a factor of 100. There just wasn't nearly enough matter. There was not nearly enough stars to hold the cluster together. So Zwicky, as we do in science, you say, well, you know, something's holding them together. Let me go with the simplest hypothesis, and that is that it's the gravity of something we can't see that does not give off light, and he called it dark matter. And so that was his idea, and that started the dark matter chase. Here's the Hubble again. I'm not going to show you all the evidence for dark matter because then we'd miss the game tomorrow. So it's just the evidence is everywhere. But here is a particularly graphic piece of evidence. You look at this beautiful Hubble picture, and now you do think something's wrong. Because look at all these galaxies whose shapes are funny. These blue ones have funny shapes. And look at this one, shaped like a ring, and another one, and another one. That must be that darn mirror that's broken again, right? They said they fixed it, but they didn't really. What's happening here is the blue galaxies are really far away. They're well behind the orange galaxies, which are a cluster. And for the light from the blue galaxies to get to us, they have to go through this cluster of galaxies. And Einstein's theory, or Einstein discovered that gravity bends light. And so the light from these distant galaxies gets bent by the cluster, and it acts like what we call a gravitational lens. And sometimes it makes multiple images. So this is all this funny-looking galaxy is all the same galaxy. Sometimes it just shears the shape of the galaxies, like so. And, it's really neat to look at. But since we know how this bending happens, we can then figure out what the mass looks like in that cluster. And so this is a picture of what the mass looks like in that cluster. And these are the two coordinates on the sky. And here's the mass. And you can pick out all the galaxies. But what's most striking about this are not the fact that this technique is so powerful you can pick out the galaxies, but this smooth mass, which actually, by the way, accounts for most of the mass in the cluster, and that's the dark matter. So there's no lack of evidence for dark matter. So when did astronomers start paying attention to dark matter? Well, it was Vera Rubin. And yeah, wouldn't you trust this person? And she had a hard path. You know, so our arch rival is Princeton. Oh, you probably don't know it is Princeton. You know, the boys finishing school in New Jersey. She applied to be a graduate student there, and they told her, well, dear, girls don't do astronomy. Now, I know at Michigan, girls do astronomy. And Vera Rubin did astronomy. She went to George Washington University. And she is the person in the 70s who convinced everyone dark matter was for real. And she did by mapping out the orbits of stars in galaxies like our own. So this isn't our galaxy. This is Andromeda. And this is called the rotation curve. And the stars, the individual stars in this galaxy, are moving around the center of the galaxy. And same story as a cluster. It's the collective gravity of the galaxy that holds it together. And you can see, you don't even need to know physics equation to see that something's wrong with this picture. So if all of the gravity, if the story of gravity of a cluster were just the stars, then you look at the stars that are further away, they're much further from this source of gravity. And if they're going to not fly away, they better be moving slower, right? When you get further away, the planets in our solar system that are farther away are moving slower because the sun's gravity is weaker out there. And if all of the gravity were due to the stars, as you got to the outer reaches of the galaxies, the speeds with which the stars orbited the galaxy would have to be slower. And even a boy can see that this is flat, okay? And that's because there's a bunch of dark matter. And so this is I apologize for this picture. It's terrible in many different ways. But this is what a galaxy really looks like. Here is the visible part, and it's immersed in a giant halo. And this is not drawn to scale. The halo's much bigger. We call it a halo. And without that halo of dark matter, the galaxy would come apart. So what is this stuff? Oh, this is fun. So it changes our whole vision of the universe. Galaxies were first discussed long before they were discovered by Immanuel Kant. And he came up with a name for them, and he called them island universes. And that's a really great name, because when you look at this picture, it really looks like all of the galaxies are kind of doing their own thing. And now let me show you what it looks like. We can't quite do this yet. So this is a computer simulation. This is what it looks like if you saw the dark matter. And so what the universe looks like, if you could see the dark matter, and this is something we're going to do with this gravitational lensing, But this is, I have to tell you, is a computer simulation. This is the distribution of dark matter. And you're going to have to bear with me here. So where it's very bright, there's a lot of dark matter. Just stick with me on this one. Where it's dark, there's not much dark matter. And the first thing you see is that the dark matter is connected in this intricate web. It's, you know, everything's connected together. And secondly, where there's a lot of dark matter, you get a lot of atoms, and they form a lot of stars, and so it's very bright. So that's why the color coding works. And so really what our universe is a cosmic web of dark matter decorated by stars. And so, for example, our galaxy, we think we're pretty independent. We're all on our own. Our halo goes out to Andromeda and is all tied up with Andromeda. And so this dark matter is a really important story, that the universe looks much more like a, you know, this is the holiday, we're getting to the holiday season, right? You put out the lights and you're looking down the street and you see these lights that just seem to be floating in space, and you get closer and see they're strung up around a tree. So it's like the universe. There's this infrastructure of dark matter. So what the heck is it? We're now going to do some math. The total amount of atoms, I told you we learned this a variety of ways, but one of the ways we learned it was from WMAP. Total amount of atoms is 4% of the total. The total amount of dark matter needed to hold the universe together is around 30%. Okay, we got a quick math quiz here. Is 4 equal to 30? Now we got one Ohio State fan there. 30 is much bigger than 4, and so there's simply not enough atoms to account for the dark matter. It's just an accounting problem. And so the dark matter has to be something other than atoms. It has to be a new form of matter. Okay, that's where we are. And here is what we've narrowed it down to be. This is where we're looking. So this was prepared in 1990. Three things we're looking at. We're looking at a particle called the axion. I'll come back to that. A particle called the neutralino. And I bet you've all heard of neutrinos before. There are a lot of neutrinos left over from the Big Bang. We know how many there are. One of the heroic things that was done over the past years was to measure the mass of neutrinos. They're really tiny. The mass of a neutrino, the lightest particle that we know of is the electron. Neutrinos weigh less than a million times what a neutrino does. But there are a lot of them, and so they account for some of the dark matter. Not that much, but some of it. We got our foot in the door. We're pinning our hopes on these two, the axion and the neutralino. These are particles that only exist in the mind of theorists. But they were not invented by astronomers. And let me focus on the neutralino. Everyone here has heard of superstrings, right? One of the predictions of superstrings is that every known particle has a superpartner. And the lightest of these superpartners has this funny name named neutralino. And there should be a lot of them left over from the Big Bang. Enough to be the dark matter. And so this is the leading hypothesis. How do we prove it? I don't want to go into how we prove it, but we can build detectors to detect the neutralinos that make up our own galaxy halo. Or the other way that we're going to start doing next year is to try to make these particles and bottle them. I didn't really mean bottle them, but there's a big new accelerator that will turn on next year. Unfortunately, it's not in Geneva, Illinois. It's in Geneva, Switzerland, called the Large Hadron Collider. And the Large Hadron Collider will try to make neutralinos. And this is a particle that we is our leading candidate for the dark matter. So I'm going to leave you with the dark matter story. We feel like we're really close. We feel like that it might be the neutralino. Maybe it's the axion. I didn't really tell you about the axion. And again, it's another example of the quarks and the cosmos connection, because where did those neutralinos come from? They came from the quark soup. So they came way back here. So here's another question. Just by the by, where did those darn atoms come from? Where did those darn atoms come from? I mean, remember, the atoms are made out of quarks. And so I want to talk very briefly about this and then run ahead to the dark energy. So here is the story. When you buy quark soup in the store, if you look on the back, it's got equal amounts of quarks and anti-quarks. And so as it cools, all the quarks and anti-quarks annihilate. You've all noticed that when you go to the store, right? So this really says, it's in the fine print here that many of you can't see. This is quark and anti-quark soup. And if you have equal numbers of quarks and anti-quarks, which is the normal way quark soup comes, then as it cools down, the quarks and anti-quarks annihilate. So then where are the quarks that make up our atoms? Well, that's a fun story, because the quark soup that our universe began with had slightly more quarks than anti-quark. For every billion anti-quarks, there were a billion and one quarks. And then, you know, when they went to the mixer, you know, there was everybody paired up, but there was one quark left over for every billion. And that quark then found friends, and that was in the neutrons and the protons. And so most of the quarks and anti-quarks annihilated. Well, so, you know, this is sort of, then where did the excess of quarks over anti-quarks come from? And I apologize for this answer. So in the early universe, we had these microscopic interactions going on, just like we have at particle accelerators today. And these quarks bumping into quarks generated a slight excess of quarks over anti-quarks. And it's a wonderful story, but it's too long for this evening. But we have atoms because of this deep connection between quarks and the cosmos. And now we're going to finish up with the dark energy, and I'm required to tell you at this point to put on your seatbelt, because we're really going to do some mind expanding here. But we'll start out slow. This is a picture that you all recognize. When your mother was teaching you about the Big Bang when you were 2 or 3 years old, she said, you know, here's the universe is expanding, so I'm imagine the size getting bigger with time. You all remember this? Universe is expanding like so, getting bigger with time, but it's slowing down due to gravity, so that this graph that I'm showing you is droopy. So instead of being a straight line like that, it's slowing down with time, and the amount by which it slows down depends on how much matter there is in the universe. If there's a lot of matter, a lot of gravity, the universe will fall back on itself. It will reach a maximum size and recollapse. If there's not very much matter, it'll do this. And so one of the big things in astronomy that astronomers have been trying to do since Hubble's time is measure this slowing down of the expansion. And this is what's really, really fun about science. 70 years of measuring the slowing down of expansion, and guess what the universe is doing? It's speeding up. Universes are the darndest thing. So 1998, the cover of Science magazine, the accelerating universe. The universe is not slowing down, it's speeding up. So how can that be? How can that be? So now I'm going to explain it and you're going to understand it. So repulsive gravity is a feature of Einstein's theory. And I don't mean that Einstein's theory is repulsive when you try to study it. What I mean is that buried deep inside of Einstein's theory is the fact that some forms of matter and energy have repulsive gravity. But the stuff that does is really, really weird. And I'll tell you a little bit about it. And here is my great contribution to this. I mean, this really is a great contribution. Because if I had not contributed this, we'd always have to say, that really weird stuff that has repulsive gravity. And I said, why don't we just call it dark energy? So this really, really weird stuff, we give it a name. It's called dark energy. It's actually a pretty good name. And so here is the explanation. I just want to test this on you and make sure you feel a lot better now. So accelerated expansion is caused by the repulsive gravity of dark energy. Are there any questions? Gee, when I give this lecture at Ohio State, there are never any questions. But so let me talk a little bit more about that. This is fun. Just to be lighthearted here. Before we use market research to come up with the name dark energy, and we first tried the name funny energy. But it wasn't serious enough. And so then that was in May of 1998. And by August, Dark Energy was much better. And but what kind of turned us to it is there's a Pokemon card for Dark Energy. Now, the bad thing about this is it turns out that the Japanese translation, two bad things about it is the Japanese translation of Dark here is evil, and it also turns out to be the Pokemon card for Dick Cheney. But okay. No more jokes here. So tell me about, I'm going to tell you about Dark Energy. So I'm going to give you an example of something that could be Dark Energy. And what this is nothing. So I have to warn you, I'm from California, this is the Zen part of the talk. So what is nothing? Well, nothing is not nothing. Nothing is something. Because according to that darn quantum mechanics again, the vacuum is not empty, it's filled, and this is something that Americans really can understand, it's filled with particles living on borrowed time and borrowed energy. Yeah, so you all get that. So according to quantum mechanics, an electron and its antiparticle, a positron, can pop out of the vacuum for a short amount of time, and this is called a subprime loan, and then it can come back together. And this stuff really, really exists, in spite of the fact that it wasn't discovered at the University of Michigan. It was discovered at Columbia University. Willis Lamb did a very careful set of experiments, and these, what we call them virtual particles, actually affect laboratory equipment. But actually, one thing was done here at the University of Michigan. Tini Veltman, the great physicist, won a Nobel Prize here, and he won a Nobel Prize for showing how these virtual particles change the masses of other elementary particles. So this stuff really, really exists. Then the issue is, well, if you've gone this far with me, if I told you that its gravity is repulsive, that's just kind of a short swallow. It's, you know, if nothing is something, why not? It has repulsive gravity. And I can prove that. Would you want me to prove that? No. Okay. And then how repulsive it is depends upon how much nothing weighs. We're in the Zen part of the talk. And this is where theorists get their tongues just get all tied up and everything, because when we calculate this, we get just about the right number to explain the speed up of the universe. And when we mean just about right, it's within a factor of 10 to the 55. And again, at Ohio State, that's good enough for them. So there's something not quite right here. Maybe it's nothing, or I'm also hedging my bets. I have something called Turner's theorem. Nothing weighs nothing. Okay, so this is why we get really excited in science. This is what, that, you know, I'm glad to see all these young people, because science is such a fun, not everything is known, and there are chances for big-time discoveries. And so this is where it really gets fun, because when you get a puzzle like this, trying to figure out why the universe is speeding up, we know, the only thing we know is it's going to take a wild new idea that looks crazy. And so when we write down our ideas, we look at it and we go, oh, man, that's just about crazy enough to be right. Now, in the fine print here is not every crazy idea is a solution to a profound problem. Some crazy ideas are just crazy. So I'm just going to quickly give you a couple of crazy ideas. In 1998, my son Joe was six. There he is at his birthday party. And I said, Joe, you know, and there I am. I'm making transparencies. I said, draw me dark energy. And here's what he drew. And I'm not going to say this is right, but I think it has as much truth as any idea I've seen. Then, you know, everybody wants to get into this. So I said, those of you who are paying really close attention will notice that this thing I called inflation is very similar. And so did Alan Greenspan. And he claims to have predicted this. There he is. He's giving a talk. He's saying, I predicted mild episodes of inflation are unavoidable. And then he put up a view graph, which I don't think has anything to do with this. But, you know, he ranted, and so he wants to get involved. Here's my crazy idea. There is no dark energy. There's something wrong with gravity. And I can put it in a nice sentence. So we've discovered a new aspect of gravity. When a universe gets empty, it starts to accelerate. Now, we put it in a really nice sentence. John Edwards would call this a bumper sticker. Unfortunately, when we try to get the equations that match it, they don't work quite so well. So we're really confused, and that's good. We're having a great time. If you're confused about dark energy, you've caught up with us. Okay. At this time in the talk, you know, people are getting a little tired, and so it's always important to put a little bit of boy-girl love in here. You'll recognize Deborah Carr and Burt Lancaster in that great movie, From Here to Eternity. And so we're now going to talk about the diagram your mother showed you about the destiny of the universe. And there's some problems here that raise a very important issue. So number one, when she talked about this, these were all droopy lines. And we now know the universe is this universe, the flat universe. So was your mother wrong? And the answer is no, because as you were falling asleep, she said, well, of course, this is a simplified picture. If you put in dark energy, then it gets more complicated. And when you have dark energy, this simple relationship between the geometry of the universe, a closed universe recollapses, an open universe expands forever, falls apart, and dark energy, until we understand what it is, we're wide open on the future. We do know we're accelerating today, so this is not a droopy line. It's moving upward. If we continue to accelerate, in 100 billion years, just around the corner, we won't be able to see but a handful of galaxies. And so when I was in Washington, I had this wonderful program for increased funding in astronomy because it's now or never. And, well, it wasn't that successful. Another possibility is that the speed up is speeding up. And if the speed up is speeding up, then things are really bad. In about 50 billion years, the universe will unzip. It'll go through what we call a big rip. Clusters will get ripped apart, galaxies, Ohio State, Michigan, University of Chicago, all the atoms in your body. Or it could be that Alan Greenspan was right and that this is just a passing mild episode of inflation and the universe goes back to the simple story. Or it could even be that the universe recollapses. So until we understand what the dark energy is, we can't answer the destiny question. So let me just sum up here. In this wonderful series that we've had on all of these different scales in the universe, I kind of bring the very smallest and the large together. I hope I've showed you that there are really important connections between the very smallest, the quarks, and the cosmos that have shaped our universe. Atoms, dark matter, dark energy, and even galaxies owe their existence to these very deep connections. And another way to look at it is this little pie chart. I guess this is a pyramid diagram of what the universe is made out of. Here are atoms weighing in at 4%. The dark matter is around 30%. The dark energy is 70%. 96% of the universe is in new forms of matter and energy. And I hope I have a slide that my daughter made. This is why it's so exciting to be an astronomer or a cosmologist right now. So I'm going to step way back. Why this lecture series has been so good is we know much about our universe. So I talked about inflation. I alluded to string theory, the hot Big Bang, massive neutrinos, dark energy, dark matter, cosmic acceleration. We know all these things, but we don't understand. The big thing is trying to put it together. So I went to my daughter, and she is really smart. And so I said, Rachel, what do we got here? And she said, Daddy, you have an elephant. That we are like the six blind cosmologists feeling the universe. We found these different aspects to it. They don't quite all fit together and make sense. And we've got the puzzle pieces here, and we have to put it all together. And that's what's going to happen. It's going to be the next generation of astronomers and cosmologists. And so, you know, if you're looking for a good adventure, come help us. Thank you very much.
No call from Mrs. Giuliani. I guess that's because we turned the cell phones off.
He found out.
I guess I should remind you to repeat questions.
I will repeat them in a way in which I can answer them.
Are there questions? Yes.
So the question had to do with this expansion of the universe. What's expanding and what isn't expanding? And so what isn't expanding is our galaxy. Our galaxy is staying the same size. Well, you will expand. You will get bigger. But that's for a different reason. And it's only the distances between galaxies. It's only the universe that's getting bigger. And what's holding our galaxy together so that it's not expanding is the gravity of the dark matter.
Back row.
This has to do with this repulsive gravity that I was talking about. And the question was, is this repulsive gravity just kind of like positive and negative charges, that positive charges or like charges repel and opposite charges attract? And no. And it's more interesting. This dark energy, this stuff that has repulsive gravity, it has so because it has a very different composition. The bad news about the dark energy, if you're imagining balling it up and using it to, you know, as anti-gravity to push things away, is that this dark energy is very hard to collect and ball up. It doesn't clump. It stays very, as far as we know, but, you know, maybe there's going to be something. So it's not as simple as like charges repelling and unlike charges attracting.
Yes.
It's just a new aspect of gravity that we've never seen before. And I know that's not a very satisfying answer. But if I were going to be really nasty, I would ask you what's attractive gravity, and you would describe your everyday experience that things fall to the earth and so. In science, we describe things, but we don't really explain the why. And so the reason this repulsive gravity seems so crazy is it's out of everyday experience. And so it's just a feature of Einstein's theory that unusual stuff can have repulsive gravity, and it turns out the universe seems to be filled with that, and so its manifestation is the universe speeding up. And we'll eventually get used to that. How would that turn, say, the last? Yeah. Yeah. So this has to do with, can the dark energy be the energy, the quantum energy of nothing? And so there are two ways we can get at that. One is to measure the properties of dark energy by carefully studying the expansion. And the University of Michigan is involved in a very exciting project called the Joint Dark Energy Mission to do that. And if it is, if what's causing the expansion of the universe to speed up is the quantum energy of nothing, when you measure the speed up very carefully, it will behave in a certain way. The other way is that we need the theorists to explain, to be able to calculate how much nothing weighs and get that right answer. And right now we haven't gotten that right answer. And I would say the puzzle is not solved, that we won't have demonstrated that what's causing the universe to speed up is the quantum energy of nothing until we do those two things. And it might not, that might not be the explanation. So we might not do those two things, but we're trying to do those two things. So right now, this is just a big puzzle. So the question had to do with connections between black holes and dark energy. And my standard answer when anybody says, could there be a connection between blank and dark energy, is, why not? But then it's up to you to show what it is. I don't know of any connection. But there could be. We just don't really understand. Just to give you how crazy the ideas are, you all know that string theory says there are extra dimensions. And one of the explanations for dark energy is that it involves the extra dimensions. And maybe someone will come up with an idea that somehow relates it to black holes. Had you asked me, could the black holes be the dark matter, I would have turned to this gentleman, who's responsible for doing weighing all the black holes in the universe. And they fail by a factor of almost a million. So we know the black holes can't be the dark matter, but somehow related to the dark energy could be.
Is acoustic wave audible?
Oh, sometimes we pick. So the question was, these acoustic waves, are they audible? The short answer is no. And in science, sometimes we pick names that are not so good, because we call them acoustic waves because acoustic waves are compressional. They're compressions, and the compressions are in the direction they travel. And that's the kind of waves these are. But you couldn't hear them. So they're not really sound waves. They're like sound waves, but you can't hear them. So that doesn't explain what you're hearing late at night. How will the what? The which telescope? Oh, the GLASS telescope. I'm not sure that the GLASS telescope is one that's going to be launched, I think, early next year. And it's got one of those names that's hard to remember, but I think it's the Gamma Ray Large Area Space Telescope. And it will study the universe with gamma ray eyes. And some of the most interesting things going on in the universe, the stuff going on around black holes, involves gamma rays. I think it won't tell us much about dark energy, but you never know, because I told you my rule over here. But what it might tell us about is dark matter. It is possible that the way we detect dark matter is dark matter particles in our halo annihilating into gamma rays. So it might tell us about dark matter. I don't think it'll tell us about dark energy, but it's going to give us a fantastic view of the universe of energetic things happening around black holes. So is dark energy uniformly distributed in the universe? as best as we can tell. We are experiencing it, but at a very, very tiny level. So the density of stuff in this table, or let's take Earth, the density of stuff in Earth is about a few grams per cubic centimeter, and the Earth is filled with dark energy, no question about it. But the density of dark energy is 10 to the minus 29 grams per cubic centimeter. And so, you know, this dark energy stuff, this is the classic example of, I don't know if it's the tortoise and the hare, but it just keeps going, right? So the way it wins is it's, you know, the Earth is just here, but the dark energy is everywhere. So even though its average density is very, very low, it wins because it's everywhere. And so here we just can't detect it because there's just so much ordinary matter. Intergalactic space is less dense, but still, that 10 to the minus 29 number is really, really small. So if you take our galaxy, the average density in our galaxy is about a factor of 100,000 bigger than that. So you can't even, it's hard to detect that way. Because we're smart? No. What's wonderful about science is when you get people from different fields, and so when you look at that large-scale structure, that funny picture I had, the red picture, if you analyze it in a certain mathematical way, Mandelbrot, I think, was the one who championed this, it looks like you could say it behaves like a fractal. And so that got a lot of cosmologists really excited for a while. But the key thing about a fractal is that when you keep looking at it on smaller and smaller scales, it just keeps repeating the same pattern, and the universe doesn't. It's made of a building block called the galaxy, and so it doesn't just keep going to smaller and smaller scales. And so that description is valid over some range of length scales, but not all length scales. And in order to have all the magical properties of fractals that Mandelbrot likes to talk about, it would have to be true over all length scales. And it isn't. You know, the fractal nature of the universe stops once you hit galaxies. It doesn't keep exhibiting the same behavior. So it's just, it hasn't proved out to be a very good way in trying to describe large-scale structure.
I wanted to give people a chance to go to the telescopes in the show tonight. So let's take one more question. I guess he gets it.
Okay. But the role of temperature? Yeah. So I didn't The microwave background told us that Hubble told us it was a Big Bang. The detection of these microwaves told us it was a hot Big Bang. And the hot Big Bang is really important because when you heat things up, when things are hot, they're reduced to their basic pieces, the quarks. And so the history of the universe was that it began hot and it's been cooling. And we know the temperature today to four significant figures. So this is a number everyone here should memorize. The average temperature of the universe today is 2.725 degrees Kelvin. Now, that's the Kelvin scale, so that's in the, you know, that's not the temperature it's going to be in Michigan in a month. That's the average temperature, and then there are various hot spots. But if you just average over the universe, that's the temperature today, and the forecast is cooling. So in another 13 billion years, it'll be half that. Thank you very much.
I want to remind people that Matt Linke in the back and I have tickets, free tickets for the Exhibit Museum Planetarium And if you go out this doorway, you can go to Angel Hall for observations in the with the telescope. Thank you.